Thank you, everyone, for coming today. I'm going to start, but keep getting food, people who need to get food. It's an informal gathering. My name is Karen Von Hippel. I'm the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project, and along with Rick Barton over there in the corner in the blue shirt and the red tie. That's the other co-director. We're really pleased today to welcome all of you to our first meeting on a new project we've launched, funded by the Luce Foundation, which is looking at the role of religion in conflict-prone settings, role of religious actors and organizations, and how the U.S. government is organizing itself to deal with religion in conflict-prone settings. And so we're looking forward to an interesting discussion today. I wanted to introduce, of course, Leora Danan, who's managing this project here on my left, and Sean Casey from the Wesley Theological Seminary, who's just walked in the door. Perfect timing. who is our religious consultant for this project as well. Please get some lunch. Okay, thank you. Now, just to briefly introduce David Steele, I think some of you may know him. He used to work at CSIS. He's been involved in on the ground, really, for over 10 years, working with religious actors in a number of conflicts in Southeast Asia, in the Balkans, and in the Middle East. And today he's going to talk for about a half an hour on his experiences, what he recommends, pros and cons of working with different types of organizations. And then we'll open the floor up to discussion. Now, there are probably too many people here to introduce ourselves. Sorry, this is really loud. when people have a question, just introduce themselves and what organization they come to, okay? So thank you very much, David.
Thank you very much, Karen and Rick and Leora, for the invitation to join with you today. And I look around the room and I see a lot of faces I don't know. So that I guess that says how long I've been away from Washington. I've been away for 3 years, and the world changes quickly, I guess. But anyway, I'm glad to be back here in a place that I really loved working at the time that I was here. And I've, as Karen has said, I've been working with the field of religion and conflict for, well, about 13, 14 years at least, full time at this point. I am a theologian by training with a PhD in Christian ethics and practical theology. I used to be pastor of a church before my career changed into what I'm doing now, which is working in international conflict resolution, primarily in training of people, both religious communities as well as others in various places in the world. In our contemporary world, religion is increasingly used as one of the most important identity markers by which many people define themselves. At a negotiation workshop I led for Shiite Iraqis in March of this year, every single participant listed religion as the foremost aspect of their identity, even more important than their names, which reflected family heritage for generations. In many places in today's world, religious affiliation is what distinguishes a group from outsiders. This is especially true when beliefs and values profoundly affect people's motivation and when mythical, mystical, and cultural rituals evoke a sense of transcendent belonging. Sometimes religion retains this role in identity formation even after a society becomes largely secularized. Even in the absence of a strong doctrinal belief system, there are still values, perceptual mindsets, and customs that set a group apart from its neighbors. Observance of religious holidays, self-perception as a chosen or a special people, or relative emphasis placed on the importance of differing ethical norms. Consequently, it's very appropriate to examine the role that religion plays in both the precipitation and resolution of conflict. And in this presentation, I intend to raise questions and make challenges for policymakers when working in contexts where religion is a significant factor. In order to provide illustration of both the dangers and the opportunities, I'll highlight the roles played by religious groups in two contexts: the Serbian Orthodox Church in Kosovo and Shiite Muslims in south-central Iraq. I draw here upon my own experience in working in both of these contexts. I've provided conflict resolution training and facilitated dialogue in Kosovo for the past 9 years, Iraq only for the past 6 months. So first, vignette, Serbian Orthodox religious mythology in Kosovo. The Battle of Kosovo, where according to tradition, perhaps not the greatest historicity, but according to tradition, the Muslim Turks defeated the Orthodox Christian Serbs in June of 1389, has become one of the primary markers of Serbian identity. In the 19th century, the ancient Kosovo folk tradition was collected and woven together into a cohesive Kosovo myth in order to support a Serbian nationalist quest for liberation from centuries of Ottoman rule. The resulting legacy was more than historical rendition, since, like other myths, it sanctioned and enacted rites which marked the boundaries of the group, established links between the people's past, present, and future, formulated certain values and oppositions that ratified and endorsed a particular ideology or philosophy, and came to represent a transcendental importance within the culture itself. Furthermore, this Kosovo myth took on clear theological dimensions, identifying the death of the 14th century Prince Lazar with the crucifixion of Christ and equating the vanquished Serb nation with the suffering of the chosen people of God. By the middle of the 19th century, the myth was used to justify territorial expansion in pursuit of liberation and to define all perceived Serbian enemies, demonizing not only the Turks, but all Muslim people, identifying them with the Antichrist. The Kosovo pledge to work toward the institution of a heavenly Serbia later motivated many Serbs to revolt against a variety of foreign dominations, including the Bosnian peasant insurrection of 1875, the Balkan Wars of 1912 and 13, World War I, where the Kosovo pledge motivated Gavrilo Princep's assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and World War II, where the spirit of Kosovo ideologically shaped the coup that overthrew a pro-Axis government in Belgrade. During the two decades leading up to the Balkan Wars of the 1990s, some figures in the Serbian Orthodox Church took a leading role in, again, nurturing the remembrance of the victimization of Serbian people by focusing on the situation in Kosovo and appealing to this Kosovo mythology. In 1969, the Holy Synod of the Serbian Orthodox Church declared that Albanian oppressors were waging genocide against the Serbian people in Kosovo. In 1982, Serbian Orthodox priests and bishops asked their hierarchy to raise its voice to protect the spiritual and biological existence of the Serb people in Kosovo and Metohija, which is their terminology for that region. Key political leaders in Serbia used this victimization theme to advance their own political careers in the 1980s. Most notable among these was Slobodan Milosevic, who appeared with Serbian Orthodox Patriarch German to celebrate Serbian history and nationhood at the 600th anniversary of the Battle of Kosovo in 1989. At this event, Milosevic ominously referred to the need for the Serbs to again be engaged in battle. Building on the Serbian Orthodox revival of the Kosovo myth, he presented himself in the leading role of that national savior. During all the violence that erupted within the former Yugoslavia during the 1990s, non-Serbs have frequently pointed to this Kosovo myth as one example of the ways in which religion has been used to inflame ethnic hatred. Turning now to Shiite Iraqis. The Battle of Karbala was fought in 680 AD on territory that is part of contemporary Iraq, giving birth to Shiite Islam. Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, had been cheated out of a promised succession to the caliphate. During the battle, Hussein and his family and a small band of followers were all massacred. The tragedy of Karbala is commemorated each year on the anniversary of Hussein's death. with groups of men performing ritual flagellation. Hussein's noble bearing and calm demeanor performed in the midst of this tragedy have been forever stored in the collective psyche of Shiites. After the death of Hussein, his followers were excluded from major leadership within the Muslim community at that time. As a persecuted minority, they developed a very hierarchical structure which gave their leadership an unchallenged level of authority. The imam was regarded not only as the spiritual and political leader of the community, but as a direct descendant of Muhammad, was also seen as sinless. This particular lineage became extinct, however, in 873 AD, when the 12th and last Shiite imam, Muhammad al-Mahdi, disappeared within days of inheriting the title at the age of 4. Shiites refused to believe that he died, instead believing he will come out of hiding and return at the end of time. Present-day Shiites have survived more than a millennium of persecution. This has led to an emphasis on martyrdom and suffering, combined with an opposition to any perceived threat to their tradition, including Western secularization. Though their leaders no longer carry the title of imam, the Ayatollahs have authority to give definitive interpretation on all religious matters and are capable of wielding enormous social and political influence. Those who become martyrs continue to have great influence, as is the case with Ayatollah Muhammad al-Sadr, who was assassinated in 1999 for criticizing Saddam's regime. His son, Shiite cleric Muqtadir al-Sadr, has now, through his family name, ascended into prominence. He has called for an Islamic state in which Shiites play the dominant role and has formed a militia named the Mahdi Army, a messianic name associated with the return of Islam's promised redeemer, who is to inaugurate a perfect Islamic society. Al-Sadr has wielded his power militarily by attacking coalition forces. Then, after the destruction of the Askariya Mosque in February of this year, turned his militias against Sunni Iraqis. He's also wielded his power politically by using his party's elected parliamentarians to cast the decisive votes in the election of former Prime Minister Ibrahim Jaafari. I use these two opening vignettes to kind of cast a picture coming from very, very different religious traditions of some of the character of very conservative elements in different religious traditions that we face today. In the case of both the Serbian Orthodox and Iraqi Shiites, we're witnessing a phenomena that is increasingly common in 21st century social conflicts. A traditional, centuries-old faith community has emerged from relative obscurity, at least in our sight, to play an influential role in its society, claiming authority in relationship to its own people and impacting the lives of other peoples and societies. In order to deal constructively with many of today's conflicts, it is important to understand this phenomenon and to find creative ways to engage it and or mitigate the negative impact of the various religious adherents. There are a number of characteristics that Serbian Orthodox, Iraqi Shiite, and other contemporary conservative religious traditions have in common. It is important to examine these characteristics and at the same time to ask serious questions about the reaction of non-believers, i.e., anyone outside the particular confines of a particular belief system. First characteristic, aversion to secularization. Fundamentalist religion rejects the secular humanist separation between the sacred and the secular. Faith must explain and embrace all of life. The socio-political realm, because it is intricately connected with issues of justice, cannot be excluded from this domain of faith. The reaction of the fundamentalist to a culture which cannot accommodate the spiritual goes beyond disillusionment. Their desire to define doctrines, erect barriers, establish borders, and control behavior springs from a basic fear that secular humanism is destroying the value system that they perceive to be foundational. Every religious community with which I worked in the former Yugoslavia blamed not themselves, which was often blamed in the West. They blamed not themselves, but secular communism and its desecration of traditional values for the social disintegration that led to the wars of the 1990s. The modern world, which seems so liberating to a liberal, appears godless, drained of meaning, and even satanic to a religious fundamentalist. In fact, the conflict of values is so fundamental that many of the ideals that one camp cherishes appear deranged to the other. Conflict over the Danish cartoons is a prime example of the depth of this ideological divide. So what can the liberal establishment do to confront this challenge? Suppression and coercion are clearly not the answer. They invariably feed fears of a conspiracy and lead to a backlash. The Shah's crackdowns inspired the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. Yet, attempting to exploit fundamentalism for secular pragmatic ends is also counterproductive. During the Cold War in the 1980s, American efforts to co-opt Islamic fundamentalists in Afghanistan helped build the Al-Qaeda movement of today. Blaming religious fundamentalists for instigating all the violence and hatred is also not the answer. Much of the rest of the world, including Muslim and Eastern Orthodox peoples, have experienced both the religious and secular West as aggressive, invasive, and imperialistic. How then can the Western secularist engage religious fundamentalists in any meaningful way? First, one cannot initiate any dialogue with an attitude of superiority that implies, I am tolerant and open, and you are not. One must find a way to engage as equals in order to discover some areas of common concern, despite the vastly differing worldviews. But the question remains, how can one welcome religious fundamentalists as equal partners in the dialogue? The only way to build consensual social norms is to start by recognizing that they, like secular humanists, in fact, like all of us, regardless of our perspective, hold their own truths to be self-evident. Second characteristic, belief in absolute truth embodied in one's own religious tradition. Conservative traditional religious communities see themselves as the custodians of divinely inspired beliefs and values. They view themselves as entrusted with fundamental truths that are beneficial for all people and that must be defended and frequently propagated. They see themselves as emissaries of truth battling against falsehood. It is a clash between good and evil, between God and the adversary. Sometimes the battles are waged through prayer and devotion, sometimes through teaching and preaching, sometimes through action, even violence, if the perceived threat to their values warrants this response from their perspective. No society, in fact, can exist without a common understanding of shared values and normative patterns of behavior that have been codified into law, which will, if implemented, often require coercion for the sake of conformity to agreed upon norms of justice. Most belief systems, religious or secular, have strong devotees with well thought out rationales for their perspective. Like the religious fundamentalist, the secular humanist views the implementation of his or her enlightenment values as beneficial to all. For the modern secularist, these constitute a set of unchallengeable, if not sacred, norms. The Western liberal is apt to be equally as adamant in supportive of his or her prized causes as the religious fundamentalist will be in advocating a particular faith perspective or the values and ethical norms that derive from it. Frequently, in such cases, the religious fundamentalist will view the secular humanist as advocating a pervasive godless ideology, secular dogmatic certainties, and coercive strategies for enforcing these values. Is it possible then, for adamant proponents of such divergent worldviews to engage meaningfully? I would say only if all parties, religious and secular, realize that the full truth is much larger than our truth. Only then can each gain a measure of real tolerance that enables them to listen more attentively to the other and to put a check on one's own enemy imaging. This mindset requires perceiving one's own truth as partial, limited, or even distorted, and then opening oneself to the corrective truth, also partial, limited, or distorted, that comes from the other. One must take the time to learn how others view the world, understand what is important to them, and seek ways to help them realize their legitimate aspirations. Even diplomats schooled in realpolitik cannot afford to ignore factors that shape attitudinal and behavioral patterns of whole cultures. Even if the power dynamics constitute the bottom line, any negotiation still requires the ability to understand and communicate with the other. The distinction, by the way, between the truth and our truth actually comes from a theologian, an American theologian, by the name of Reinhold Niebuhr, one of the 20th century's leading theological and political realists. Furthermore, Niebuhr's recognition of the critical role of power dynamics, which is why he aligned himself with the realist tradition, this did not protect him from espousing tolerance. For Niebuhr, there was a tension between never knowing anything with absolute certainty and still having to maintain the necessary conviction which leads to definitive action. If one has only limited understanding, then tolerance toward those who disagree was essential, as seen by this advocate of realpolitik. This perspective, I believe, is even more important in the 21st century, when power is no longer exclusively in the hands of state actors, if it ever has been. But certainly today it has devolved. To borrow an image from Thomas Friedman, the world is flat. In such a global village, cultural sensitivity and religious understanding are key factors in the resolution of conflicts centered around values. Third characteristic, the reality of present suffering and victimization contrasted with ultimate victory and redemption. Both Serbian Orthodoxy and Shiite Islam have a deeply ingrained theology of victimhood. Suffering and self-sacrifice of the whole people is viewed as a form of atonement, a process of purification. Yet fundamentalist religion also relies on the messianic vision of a better future, even a perfect end time. The promise of ultimate peace and justice gives the believer the strength to endure any present misery. The way to this future, though, is usually seen as a form of struggle. People who have lived for centuries under foreign domination often develop a culture of humiliation and a strong sense of cultural unity in the face of threat. There is a tremendous pride in one's people, a need to affirm their strengths and either hide or redeem their failures. Most Westerners, on the other hand, come from a culture that believes that anything is possible for one with adequate initiative and motivation. One does not need to hope for pie in the sky. This deeply ingrained individualistic culture of the West, with its emphasis on personal choice, freedom, and opportunity, is fundamentally different from the common communal cultures of much of the rest of the world, where the focus is on loyalty to one's family, clan, or tribe. Western ideals of emancipation have frequently been perceived in other cultures as undermining indigenous peoples' authority within their own social structures. In order to bridge this chasm of experience and expectation, the Westerner, or indeed anyone whose basic needs have been adequately met, needs to develop a sensitivity to suffering. Growing an understanding of the sense of victimhood in each context, empathizing with those who experience the pain. How can one communicate to the other that one is seeking to understand? This, I say, must precede any attempt to accomplish anything else. The only approach that can succeed is one that first builds solidarity. In the case of religious fundamentalists, this means meeting them on their own terms and utilizing wisdom from their own traditions to engender hope. Within all religious traditions, there are elements of the tradition that can be used to stretch the believer's perceptions. The challenge is to use their own frame of reference, then to raise questions, pose alternative viewpoints, and help them see a creative way to move beyond their sense of victimization. When I conducted training seminars in conflict resolution for religious people in the Balkans, I frequently led them through a cyclical process designed to utilize their faith in order to escape from a cycle of victimization and revenge. I often began by exploring the lament motif, a grief process encapsulated in many Old Testament psalms, as a way of sharing one's suffering in the context of faith and hope. When working with Serbian Orthodox priests from both sides of the Serbian-Bosnian border immediately after the Bosnian War, I heard and acknowledged the pain of losing family members during that war, including the loss of life due to NATO bombing. I then traced the development of this lament motif into the time of the Old Testament prophets, demonstrating how Jeremiah and Isaiah added a call for confession of sin to their accounts of the suffering of their own Israelite people. When challenged to apply this model of compassion, coupled with self-examination, a deputy to the bishop of the Serbian Orthodox Church recounted how a Serbian soldier who had been given orders to massacre Muslim civilians, how this man had come to him in confession. A ritual performed in the front of the church during Orthodox liturgy, not off in some side cubicle as in Catholicism. In other words, in front for everyone to see that he was walking forward. The deputy bishop, after telling this story, then challenged all Serbian Orthodox priests that were present in the room to acknowledge the terribly destructive role that their soldiers, their government, and their church had played in the Bosnian War. I was shocked to hear a deputy bishop of the Serbian Orthodox Church on the border of Bosnia make that kind of statement, and yet he did. This acknowledgement was then shared with Muslims from the region, an act that led to the development of an interfaith group that later performed many joint activities and established an interreligious center in Belgrade, a center, by the way, that is still in existence today. Among other faith projects, the center sponsored workshops for religious leaders and public educators to discuss how best to handle the teaching of religion in the schools. Presenting a call to confession as an integral part of Serbian Orthodox faith, and in the context of identifying with Serbian suffering, despite the fact that in the West we knew most about, and legitimately most about, Bosnian Muslim suffering, nonetheless recognizing their own suffering, this had enabled a faithful and courageous church leader to take a very important step on the path toward reconciliation with other religious and ethnic communities. My fourth characteristic, identity as a chosen people with a mission. Religious fundamentalists see themselves as a chosen people, called to carry out a divine mission. In most cases, this mission includes support for conservative social stances that will preserve the values of the family, tribe, clan, or faith tradition. Typically, the focus is on issues like sexuality, the role of women, observance of religious customs. In the case of both the Serbian Orthodox and Shiite Muslims, this mission can be interpreted as justifying action that is required in order to protect one's people or to further promulgate the faith. The theology of Saint Savism in Serbian Orthodoxy permits the annihilation of anything that stands in the way of achieving heavenly Serbia. In Shiite Islam, the lesser jihad can be used, not always, but can be used, to legitimize war against the enemies of Islam. In each case, violence can be legitimized only when they perceive that injustice has been done. Given the sense of victimhood and humiliation that these societies experience, it's very easy for these people to then justify the resort to violence. Typically, the loss, grief, and anger experienced by one side leads to the creation of a mythology of heroes, villains, and the right interpretation of events. The cycle goes around again, each time involving more and more people in each group. Each group sees itself as the victim who is pursuing justice. To the other group, however, they are perceived as aggressors. To outsiders, it often looks like a revenge mentality, not justice, that has become the predominant paradigm, fueled often by a messiah complex. Again, any attempt by an outsider to address these issues must begin with understanding empathy, a sense of solidarity with each group, and an ability to utilize the fundamentalist's own tradition to raise questions and pose alternatives. Coming toward the end of the time that I have allotted and a bit more to say, so I'm going to depart from my notes here and indicate some of my experience with these groups that has been positive and not just negative. I've focused largely on the negative impact that many of these groups have. I've worked a great deal with the Serbian Orthodox Church in Kosovo, and might note that when I began working with them, which was about 1997, before the Kosovo War, the bishop of the Serbian Orthodox Church in Kosovo, as well as some of his principal assistants in the form of Serbian Orthodox monks, came out with some of the strongest statements against the Milosevic regime that I heard anywhere in Serbia. Despite this nationalistic background and this fervor, they came out with statements decrying the abuse of Albanians by the Milosevic regime and calling, actually, for the Milosevic regime to be turned out of government. It was an astounding statement on the part of a bishop of a church in the region that had, in fact, fomented a lot of the ethnic and religious nationalism of the Serbian people. He did not, however, forego some of the concerns that he had that, in fact, derived from that whole history. His concern, actually, was very much because he feared that Milosevic's policies would, in the end, become detrimental to the Serbs. He was absolutely right in that prediction. In fact, what happened to the Serbian population in Kosovo followed on what happened to the Serbian population in much of the rest of the Balkans, where many people became refugees or internally displaced persons, and the internal populations that stayed often became the most disadvantaged or among the most disadvantaged peoples in that region. And so he ended up then really becoming very much opposed to a lot of the change that has taken place since the end of the war, and very much in opposition now to Kosovo-wide institutions and in opposition to a lot of international efforts that have been made to bring Kosovo forward. At the same time, the Patriarchate in Belgrade has recently established a second bishop in Kosovo who is much more interested in dialogue with the Albanian community as well as the international community in Kosovo. And they've done this because they fear that the first bishop's very negative approach to all political issues at this point is going to further alienate the Western community and alienate Kosovo Albanians, and therefore end up jeopardizing the Serb position even more. So they have actually established a second bishop whom they have given all responsibility now for political issues to that person. And he is currently involved in negotiating very closely with the person who is in charge of developing the Albanian plank for cultural heritage issues in the final status talks in Kosovo. They're actually engaged in extremely interesting and extremely encouraging proposals for how, in fact, they might be able to live together as one people, recognizing the cultural diversity that exists. It's a remarkable change of course, actually, for a church that just a few years ago had been written off as not only irrelevant, but actually one that was hindering the any kind of progress in ethnic integration in Kosovo. So it's a mixed bag as we look at it. even as also the history and culture of the Shiites in Iraq is a mixed bag. My experience there is less than it is in Kosovo, but I recently have been involved in the training of Shiite Iraqis from South Central Iraq in negotiation skills. And what we've attempted to do actually is to train people in some typical Western kinds of perspectives, but with a sensitivity to the fact that these have to be adapted in order to fit their cultural norms. And they do that as they adapt it. And so we now, we can go into more of this if you want in dialogue later on, but I want to finish up rather quickly. Some of the people that we have trained, actually using a mix of both the training that they've received from us, and which is called interest-based negotiation, which I can explain more later, coupled with some of their own secular tradition, or not secular, their own religious traditions, as well as their own tribal customs, they've been actually able to negotiate within the Shiite community itself a number of significant conflicts, including armed conflicts. There are two cases where participants of ours have negotiated ceasefires between armed groups, of Shiites fighting Shiites in South Central Iraq. In another case, negotiating over the whole question of teaching of religion, of Shiite Islam within the schools, and how in one particular community they were able to successfully negotiate this between radical Shiite fundamentalist groups and others who did not want this to take place within the teaching of the school system. And so, again, there's, on the one hand, there's a lot of tradition that would make one think that it would be very difficult to negotiate with anybody outside that group, yet they're able to still meet with us as Westerners, be able to learn from us as we learn also from them, and be able to play a significant role within their society. These same people who represent a mixture of people within their societies, some governmental people, some non-governmental people, a good many of them, in fact, are provincial governmental people who have been newly elected to positions of responsibility in that region. They now have turned to us and basically said, can you help us now to dialogue with Sunnis? You've helped us in attempting to look at how we might resolve our own internal conflicts among the Shiite. Can you do that? So I've recently been in contact with USIP and with the embassy in Baghdad about the possibilities for, it's not the first time this would happen, certainly. It's happened other places too, I know. But about the possibility of creating dialogue then between Shiite Iraqis from South Central Iraq with Sunnis from other parts of the country. I'll finish up with a few final points here, particularly aimed toward policymaking in this country. How can the Western secularist meaningfully engage religious fundamentalists as equals? How can they avoid attitudes of superiority when engaging them? What common concerns might there be? How might you attempt to build solidarity with those coming from a religious culture of victimization, or one dominated by a sense of humiliation, or one driving a very conservative social agenda that denies rights and freedoms that are typically guaranteed in Western democracies? In framing this challenge, I refer to a recent appeal made by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, President of the Islamic Republic of Iran, to President Bush. It's significant that Ahmadinejad appeals to Bush as a person of faith. In his personal letter that he writes to Bush, he appeals to him as a follower of Jesus Christ. He closes the letter by stating, "Liberalism and Western-style democracy have not been able to realize the ideals of humanity. These concepts have failed. We increasingly see that people around the world are flocking toward a main focal point, that is, Almighty God. Through faith in God and the teachings of the prophets, the people will conquer all of their problems. Do you not think, Mr. Bush, that if all of us come to believe in and abide by these principles, worship of God, justice, respect for the dignity of man, belief in the last day, that we can overcome the present problems of the world? Do you not think that belief in these principles promotes and guarantees peace, friendship, and justice? Mr. President, will you not accept this invitation and join with those who believe in these principles?" Some may dismiss Ahmadinejad as insincere, but I believe he's making a genuine plea to a fellow religious fundamentalist, asking him to recognize some common ground. We may not like the common ground he's asking them to recognize, but it's fascinating to appeal to common anti-secularist values rooted, he claims, in all of the monotheistic religious traditions. It is an appeal that is generated within the Islamic framework, and certainly this is reflected in the specifics of what he says, yet he aims the appeal beyond just the Islamic framework. It's an attempt to build solidarity with an adversary that calls upon both of them to look beyond the truth of one's own particularity and to find something in common. An Islamic fundamentalist reaching beyond his own tradition, attempting to reach common ground with a Christian fundamentalist, albeit at the expense of the secularist. Could the same phenomenon be achieved between the fundamentalist and the secularist? And what implications does this have for U.S. foreign policy? Too often, I believe, U.S. foreign policy is depicted as an epic struggle between good and evil, where the good is what we embody in our democratic traditions. Often, but not always, has this been the case. Early in the Cold War era, I think we experienced a different kind of approach to the rest of the world. At the beginning of that era, U.S. foreign policy was guided by a tradition that did fight against evil, but was not convinced that we or our systems were entirely inherently good. And it took concrete steps to avoid taking on a mentality of empire. There was the knowledge that we too could be corrupted by power, and therefore needed always to be vigilant regarding our own fallibility. The architects of U.S. foreign policy in the beginning of the Cold War made significant efforts to bind our policy to transnational institutions like NATO and the United Nations. George Kennan believed that America's greatest advantage in the Cold War was that, unlike the Soviet Union, which held its alliance together by force, the U.S. should build alliances that respected foreign nationalism. In the Marshall Plan, we did this, even supporting Europe's socialist parties. Truman himself said that America should seek European allies strong enough to say no to both the Soviet Union and the United States, if necessary. However, in our one superpower post-9/11 world, I think the U.S. seems to have forgotten the need to tailor its foreign policy to include the wishes of others. This does not mean no intervention in the internal affairs of other states, I don't believe. In the modern world, I think we've reached a threshold where that may in fact be necessary in some form. But first, this must be legitimized by international bodies and in accord with international agreements. Inherently, this is like the checks and balances of our own democratic system. Second, we must be willing to examine ourselves and hold ourselves accountable to the same standards that we promote for others. According to recent polls, most Muslims in the world do not consider democracy to be an alien notion, but they question whether U.S. foreign policy is pursuing it within their regions. And third, we must be willing to give decision-making power to local people and institutions. In other words, our own policy must rely on persuasion and not on coercion. Underlying all of this is the need for a spirit of humility that couches the truth that we wish to impart in our own democratic traditions with a recognition that ours is a partial truth that needs to be in dialogue with even our fundamentalist antagonists. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, David, and thanks for sticking to the time schedule. I think we'll have a lot of questions in the room. I mean, I was struck by a number of things that you raised. I thought it was interesting, this issue in Kosovo in particular, that Milosevic, who's actually not a religious person really, who uses religious myth to wind people up Battle of Kosovo Polje, and yet when the UN mission was set up, the Serb Orthodox Church was the only moderate interlocutor the mission had to speak to at the time. So, and there's lots of interesting paradoxes. And, of course, this question of secular speaking to fundamentalists and how they do that, that's a real challenge that I think we're facing in a number of parts of the world. Let me open up the floor, and maybe we'll take a couple questions at a time because there are a lot of people here. And can I remind you to please introduce yourselves as well and say where you're from? Thank you. Is that all right?
Thank you very much for the my name is Lucas. I come from East Timor, and I have been in counseling at IFES. I think this topic is very interesting for me because this is very much related to East Timor during colonization by Indonesia. And we have cultural diversity as well, like religion. Yeah, that's why I have two questions. I just want to know, based on your experience. You were mentioning about the dialogue, the both the religion, then they have conflict. So how do you embrace those different groups of religions in order to sit together to debate and find solutions? And the next, how do you respond to the victim that victimized by the conflict?
Thank you.
I said a very little bit about that in the long presentation I gave, but I can elaborate a bit more. First of all, what I traditionally do when I was working especially here at CSIS and directing my own program, I spent a great deal of time building relationships before I tried to do anything else. In relating to the Serbian Orthodox Church in Serbia, for example, I spent 2 years on the ground building relationships before I tried to even hold any event in pulling together different ethnic and religious communities in that country. And I'll use it as an example. There's other kinds of examples one could use, but this one sticks in my mind. I built a relationship with the Serbian Orthodox bishop from the northern part of Serbia, which is the most interethnic part of that country, a region called Vojvodina. And I spent time simply going and talking with him. As a theologian, I could talk theology with him, which is a great advantage to when you're attempting to sit down and talk with an Orthodox bishop who's also extremely well-educated with a PhD. We would talk both theology and politics. We wouldn't always agree, many times disagree over things, but there established a relationship between us. This was in the years of, beginning in 93 until 95. And during that time, I came to enjoy the interactions with him. I often wouldn't like some of the conclusions he was drawing, but nonetheless, I enjoyed the interaction. I think that was evident and part of the dynamic that was building the relationship. I finally decided that it was time to attempt to build to have an inter-religious event, bringing together the different religious communities within that region of Serbia. And I moved in this direction despite still the negative assessment on the part of my Serbian Orthodox consultant in Serbia. Although the other consultant I had was Roman Catholic, and she was very much in favor of moving ahead, and she was the consultant in Vojvodina. So we decided to move ahead anyway and to hold a training session in the northernmost city of Serbia, where the majority population was not Serb and not Orthodox, but it was actually Catholic. It was a combination of Croatian, ethnic Croatian, and ethnic Hungarian Catholics that were predominant in that particular city. So I figured if the Orthodox didn't come, then it wouldn't be horrible. There's quite a religious diversity within that area, and so they would represent just one of the minority traditions that did not come. Well, it turned out that they sent three priests, actually, to participate in this. This bishop sent three priests. And I knew that it was all a test to see whether or not this would be something that would be anti-Serbian. And it was a very, very difficult environment in which to hold this particular talk. I made the mistake, actually, of holding it in a place called the Free University, which sounded great to me. But from the Serbian perspective, it was horrible because Milosevic was most certainly spying on whatever happened. Everybody in the room was absolutely positive that they were being taped. In anything that they said, which was only confided to me during the sessions outside the room. And so despite that, we actually managed to develop some rapport, I believe. And at the next event, which actually was held in Hungary, southern Hungary, and brought people together from Serbia, Croatia, and Bosnia, the same bishop sent more people again. And by the time I went to him to ask for participation in the third event, I just happened to run into him in the Patriarch in Belgrade, and he said, permission granted, before I even asked the question. By that point in time, he had come to the point of at least sensing that it was possible to trust me. I think that was the biggest thing. In fact, this never ended up developing into anything, but at the time I had been teaching in a summer school in Macedonia as well, and had been basically presenting what different religious communities had done in different places around the world in order to bring about social change within their own societies. And some of the students that were involved in this, in fact, I remember specifically Macedonian Orthodox students said to me, well, we don't have this connection with all these bishops. You've got connection with these bishops. Why don't you do something? And so I thought about it, and I said, well, I was going back to see the same bishop in Vojvodina after this, and I was going to see another bishop in Bosnia, an Orthodox bishop. And so I decided to, well, what do I have to lose? I can ask him, you know, is it possible to establish any kind of back-channel communication with the Bosnians? This is still during the war at this time, during the Bosnian War. And his response was cautious, but saying yes. And I said, I have in mind, actually, a particular Bosnian who's been through one of our workshops in Sarajevo. I named the man. The bishop knew him. He'd met him before the war. And he said, yes, if you can establish some kind of connection with him. This was president of the Academy of Sciences and Arts in Sarajevo, and a fairly prominent Bosnian Muslim. And so I then later talked with the Bosnian Muslim about the possibility of setting up a back-channel dialogue. He was open to it as well. It ended up not happening. I won't go into all the details as to why it didn't. Really details that were outside the ability of either of those two men or me to influence. But it was a clear indication that this bishop had come to the point of trusting me enough so that he'd be willing to work through me and through CSIS, basically, as a conduit for unofficial back-channel communication between sides in the Bosnian War. I'd say it's all about building trust. It's a long way of answering your question with some examples.
Okay, let me take three questions now. So Sean, and then you, and then Shannon.
David, this is very helpful. I appreciate it. And I clearly like your motif of the linking of the reality of present suffering to sort of the ultimate messianic or apocalyptic vision and the power of that. I've got two questions, one sort of philosophically oriented, one practically oriented. On your question of my truth as partial truth versus truth with a capital T, as attractive as that is to me, given my social location, that still, I think, has a air of liberalism, capital L, written on it. Mm-hmm. That if you go into a community that really does believe their truth is truth with a capital T, that's almost a non-negotiable from the start. So it seems to me that is a version of kind of liberal, hegemonic effort there to make somebody admit that before they get in. And I'm wondering how do you deal with that. And secondly, I think the beauty of your model is you get religion out on the table from the very start. It's overt, it's named. But as I am learning and becoming a student of post-conflict reconstruction, it seems to me there are alternate ways of dealing with religion. I would like to get your reaction to maybe some alternate models, like a lot of interfaith dialogue focuses not on the faith part, but actually on the practical task part, and avoids discussion of overt theology, but concentrates solely on the task of reconstruction. And so you try to push religion aside and focus only on the practical. Or a modification that would be the ad hoc model, where you only deal with religion as it comes up related to the practical work. And then maybe the third model is the democratic religious freedom model that says the way you really get into religion is not to talk about the theological differences as it is to try to sell everybody on religious freedom as the entry. And it seems to me those are alternate visions to yours. I'm curious if you might just quickly react to one or two of those.
Great, thanks. Can you introduce yourself, too?
Cultural dialogue in true, genuine, peaceful coexistence between
Okay. Addressing your questions first here, there's a lot in your questions, so I'm going to be brief and hopefully we'll try to be brief anyway. Is it too liberal to talk about my truth versus the truth? Yes, it is. It is liberal. I would say that one does not need to say that or convince somebody else of it in order to practice doing what I'm advocating. I think it's possible to set one's own understanding somewhat to a side in order to understand the other and to affirm things that come out of that. And then you can hopefully build upon commonalities. And what I often find is that despite how rigid a particular system may be, that I invariably find people within it who are willing to enter into that kind of dialogue if they sense there's a respect for where they're coming from. And they may not even acknowledge that they are departing at all from their truth, and that's okay. I don't think they need to. What about focusing on practical tasks, not just on religion? Absolutely. That's certainly a very valid thing to do. I focus here on talking about religion, and that's, I guess, a lot of what I saw to be the purpose of this particular presentation. At the same time, in a lot of the work I've done, particularly in the Balkans, has been helping people to begin to work together, including both dialogue and work together. I've had people working on refugee return, for example, from religious traditions that grow out of a dialogue process. It can also happen the reverse. The dialogue can accompany the working together. I think that the most creative processes, in my opinion, are ones that include both. And where one starts might be a question of one's particular orientation or where the people are themselves. Selling everyone on religious freedom, I personally think that's important to do, but I wouldn't start there because I don't think that it's something that is going to be acknowledged as important or even advisable by many peoples. And so I would never start at that point. I would simply attempt to build some commonality that allows for dialogue to begin to develop that perhaps at least helps begin people, including myself, to begin to move somewhat as we adjust to that interaction. And if that leads somebody to the position of affirming religious freedom, then fine and good. But if it doesn't, then I don't feel personally that I have the right to enforce that before they begin a dialogue process with me. The impact of the current law and religion in Kosovo. I have to admit that I haven't followed all of that real recently. I followed it toward the beginning. But what I would say is that the biggest concerns that I've heard, back when it was being debated very hotly, I received complaints actually from two religious communities by email. One was the Serbian Orthodox, and the other was the Evangelical Protestant communities within Kosovo. Both of which claimed that this would severely limit their ability to function for different reasons they had. In the case of the Serbian Orthodox, I think it was limiting what they saw being their predominant role within their society and culture. And with the Evangelical Protestants, it was limiting because they did not have the numbers on the books that would qualify them for official recognition. And their complaint was that they have to be seen as an association, same as any secular organization, rather than acknowledged for being the religious institutions that they were. And so there are criticisms that I'm aware that come from different communities about that law. I don't know as I'm in a position really to personally say a lot as to what I think ought to be changed. What I would attempt to do there would be simply to create more dialogue between and among those parties in order for them to resolve that. I think that's much more important than for me as an outsider to come in with a particular solution that I think is best. That's generally the approach I take to most things. But I haven't specifically dealt with that issue, and so I'm not up probably as much as you are on some of the details. Commonality between Shiites in Iraq and Iran. I've not worked with Iranians. I have worked with Iraqis, and I'd say a couple of things there. One is that there certainly is a connection. The Shiite faith does connect people. There are a number of leaders among the Shiite Iraqis that spent time in Iran during Saddam's regime, including predominant people in political power today. There were some people among our participants in our seminars for whom that was true as well. They had spent time living in Iran during that period. Therefore, yes, there's certainly a connection. And as you, probably many of you know, the Ayatollah Sistani is ethnic Iranian, the Ayatollah who is the head of the Shiite Iraqis. So yes, there are connections. At the same time, at least in my dialogue with them, these people I was working with made it very, very clear that they were Arab. They were not Persian. And there are definite cultural differences. And they also referred a great deal to many of them having lived through the Iran-Iraq War, a lot of which was fought on the territory in which they lived, and the tremendous suffering that came as a result of that war. So I'd say there's in some senses, a close connection, and yet there's also an awareness of cultural differences and of ethnic identity that is different and separate. There, one of the things that we did in working with the Iraqis is to have them actually role-play their own conflict situations. And it was very interesting in this one case, conflict that occurred right along the border of Iran and Iraq. And the conflict was really between local provincial authorities and the local head of one of the Iraqi tribes. It was obvious that this tribal head had all kinds of connections with the Iranians. And there was all kinds of accusations of smuggling of who knows what. I don't know all the details across the border from Iran. And that this had a tremendously significant role to play in terms of the economy, actually, of that region. And yet the provincial government people were attempting to gain some kind of control over corruption, as they stated it. So they wanted to, we were encouraging them, actually, to role play this situation, to somebody role play the tribal leader who had all these connections with the Iranians. I was doing back deals with them, and other people to role-play the provincial leadership within that province of Iraq. It's very interesting that nobody in the group wanted to play the role of the tribal leader. They kept battling it back and forth. No, you play it. No, you play it. No, you play it. Nobody wanted that role. And so it kind of, for me, demonstrated some of the huge tensions within that Shiite community now. In some cases, that tribal authority is extremely important and dominant even today. It basically filled the vacuum when Saddam fell, when there was no other authority at all. Now you have provincial government people coming in wanting to claim that authority based on elections, and yet you've still got the tribal leaders that they're dealing with, and huge conflict sometimes exists between them. And in this case, it relates to what kind of connections they have with Iran as well. And so all that's a dynamic going on that I think pervades a lot of what's happening in that part of Iraq today.
Thank you. Just before I pass it to another question, how many evangelical Protestants are there in Kosovo? I wasn't aware there were any.
Well, actually, it's an interesting story. I know some of them quite well. There are a couple of brothers that I know who pastor an evangelical Protestant church in Pristina who are both sons of the first evangelical pastor in Kosovo, who was converted, actually, when he served in the Yugoslav military, when he served in Croatia.
Are they Serbs or Albanians?
These are Albanians. Oh, and basically, what they have recounted to me is that the evangelical community, according to them, now has the same number of people as the Catholic Church in Kosovo, if you take all of them together. And the difficulty in measuring that is who is a part of the evangelical community today, because their connections are so diffuse, and you know, someone may have converted to that basic orientation yet never officially joined a church, and the records are such that they aren't even allowed to exist as a church. They're only allowed to exist as an association, and so it's very difficult to verify what the numbers are. But I know numbers of other people who are not evangelicals who would say that that both evangelical Protestantism and a more radical Islam are both the fastest growing religious movements in Kosovo today.
So that's really fascinating. Okay, sir, please, and then afterwards.
Thank you, David, for your presentation, but also for the work you're doing. I'll evolve into the question I want, but an observation. I sense that your way of working is more from the storytelling, beginning to have people share, develop develops an empathy and then move to more practical things in which they have to wrestle. Do you ever get into the point where you're really, where they're sharing a sense of the holy mystery that underlies what truth they know is doctrine? And that is a kind of side question. My real question of you is, what can you say, or what are your observations about the training of America's Foreign Service officers in this kind of cultural sensitivity? And are they being helped to even talk theology?
Can you introduce yourself? I'm sorry.
I'm Richard Griffiths, United Nations Association.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, sir, and then. No, you. Sorry, please. Yeah.
I think she had
okay.
Before.
I'm Sakina Abdul-Rahim. I'm a student with the Graduate School of Islamic and Social Sciences. I'm a master's student. And actually, this is a big interest for me. My question is more related to the Iraq situation and the Iraq war. In terms of your approach to conflict reconstruction and conflict reconciliation, are you considering approaching it from the Islamic concept or the context or Islamic worldview, or have you considered that?
Okay.
And also, one more comment, have you considered also the effects of post-victim ethical exemption syndrome, which is basically the psychological effects that are occurring and the whole rationalization of violence and how it's being advocated and what it's creating in relation to jihad and other issues that come up and insurgency. That's one of my major interests in research.
So great, thank you.
You can comment on that a little bit.
My name is Frank Dahl. I work with Creative Associates. I'm actually an Anglican theologian, but I'm now second, so I've been out of all of that for some time. Basically, I think my first question starts, if we're beginning to discuss the theological repercussions of all of this, we need to look at this whole notion of a just war or not a just war. And many of us, certainly European theological fora, probably can't justify a just war. And I've heard that justified so often here as part and parcel of justifying a political thing, which is an invasion of a country in the 21st century. But that, for me, sort of sticks in my gullet. And I was involved in the reconstruction of Iraq in trying to get the educational system going. I was in there at the very beginning. And worked with the educators that I had known before wearing a UNICEF hat, because I was part of UNICEF for many, many years in the Middle East. I went into the ministry, followed by a lot of people who were definitely not UN after the invasion. And most of everybody I knew just melted away into their homes and didn't want anything to do with us. The whole object of going practical and handing over the process of reconstruction to the local population, I think, is well taken. The big mistake I think we made in Iraq from the very beginning is that we didn't do that. We imposed ourselves. In every single ministry, we imposed ourselves with teams of people. We drove everybody away, and we alienated ourselves from the very beginning. The other point I was going to raise is the point to do with the whole issue of Islam and nationalism. We make generalizations about the Iraqi situation that I know pretty well, and we make generalizations about Shias in Iraq being closely linked to Shias in Iran. If you see what drives Iraq historically, you will see that it's an antagonism against Iran as a state, and there's a history of bloodshed and suffering that goes with that, that would force probably most Iraqi Shias not to side automatically with Shias in Iran. That's, I think, an internal problem. One of the things we counted when we hit the ground was that there were at least 12 Shia groups in the Basra area, all of them with different points of view about how to handle all of this immediately after the invasion. And people failed to and want to understand that further in order to be able to build on those differences in order to do the kind of reconstruction that we needed to do properly. But basically, in many ways, just going to the practical if we can might be the way to go in these very complex and difficult situations. But in the end, I don't think it's as simple as that. I don't think you could just revert to the practical, although it would be very nice to do that. Those of us in development, and there are lots of people probably around the table with years of development experience, would like to do that. Keep, in a sense, religion out of it, make it, neutralize it, and then just do the practical thing in a humanitarian way. But I think that's increasingly difficult to do, because we have a layer of policy and politics now that is being imposed on that whole very delicate have been trying for many years.
Okay, thank you. David, more very good questions.
Yes. All of these, by the way, could obviously take a long time to really go into. Storytelling. Yes, actually, that is very much the keystone for how I perceive my approach. What I attempt to do is to get people to sharing stories and experience with one another. Depending on the particular group, depending on the dynamics of the culture of the situation, I may do that sooner or later in a process. But what I attempt to do is to begin to help people to share their own sense of suffering, which in the context of war or post-war is bound to be there on the part of everyone in a society, no matter what group they're associated with, and to begin to help people to listen to one another's stories of what that suffering is like. And what I find is that if, in fact, the stories are kept to the personal, this is my experience, or this is my friend's experience, even if it is one person removed, it's something that somebody can recount that has a vividness to it. I only remember one time in 13 years of doing this when anybody questioned someone else telling about their own personal experience. They would question all kinds of assumptions that got made as a result of somebody telling their experience, conclusions that they may have drawn from it. But the actual experience itself would not be questioned. And there's one case where it was, happened to be somebody who knew that other person and basically came up to me afterwards and said, that's not the way it was. I know because I knew this person and I know the whole context. But basically people did listen to one another. I remember being in Croatia, for example, the very first workshop I ever ever led myself, I wouldn't say participated in. It was a very powerful example of, it was actually a Croatian Baptist pastor who started off by talking about how he was knifed by Serbian troops and his teenage daughter was raped in front of him. And he was asked, how did you respond to this? And he said, well, I basically said that the soldiers who were attacking me asked me if I could sing Serbian songs. And I said, no, I can't sing Serbian songs, but I can sing gospel songs. And he said they kind of looked at me. Strange. Then they said, they literally started saying to each other, what are we going to do with him? They turned to me. They said, what are we going to do with you? And he said, why don't you ask God what to do with me? It totally threw these Serbian soldiers way off any kind of plan that they had to do anything beyond that. And he said, they left us alone. That's probably how he and his daughter survived on the attack. He shared this story in a small group with a Serbian Orthodox priest also in the group who had lived in Croatia during the whole war, which is unusual for a Serbian Orthodox priest. After he finished the story, the Serbian priest spoke and said, I was taking my wife to the hospital one day, and we were attacked by Croatian troops. They shot me 3 times, and I survived. And months later, one of the Croatian soldiers came to me and said, I have to tell you that we were ordered to do this because you're a Serbian Orthodox priest, but I believe it was wrong. It was wrong for me to take part in that kind of activity. And can you forgive me? And the Serbian priest said, I forgave you a long time ago. And when he was asked by other people in the group, how could you do that? He said, well, I'm a Serbian Orthodox priest. I was trained in a monastery in tranquility. And that's how I could do it. It totally blew the minds of non-Serbian Orthodox people in that group because it's not their image of how a Serbian Orthodox priest would respond. These are two people who both coupled their sense of suffering with their understanding of faith. And that's what I often ask people to do. In fact, I ask people to do this sort of variation of it if I'm dealing with secular people. I ask them not only for their suffering, but what brought them through it? What helped them in the process? If they're religious people, they usually come from an orientation of faith. If they're not, they bring other kinds of resources to the story. And begin sharing these among people. That begins to build bonds between them. What happened in that particular workshop was other people began hearing about what had happened in that small group and wanted to know more of the details. And even some ethnic Hungarians who got caught in the middle of this war because they happened to live in that part of Croatia that got attacked, began coming to both the Croat and the Serb and saying, we're trying to just figure out how to live in the midst of this war between your peoples. can you help us to understand what's going on? So it became a real building effort of relations between people. So you asked also about training for American foreign policy officers. I don't have a lot of experience with this one. When I worked here in CSIS, I was involved on the order of once, maybe twice a year, in going to the Foreign Service Institute in order to help in training of Foreign Service diplomats who were headed for the Balkans, because that's where I was working exclusively. And I was particularly brought in order to deal with the topic of religion in the Balkans. I believe that they were doing that also in other regions of the world, although I don't know all the specifics. And I would guess probably that's still going on, but I don't really know. I haven't been involved in it since I left Washington in early 2003. Moving on, approach to Islamic values. I have to admit that I come as a Christian theologian, therefore I'm far more familiar with Christian theology than I am with Islam. I'm learning. And that's really the way that I approach it, is that when I'm in dialogue with Iraqis, for example, I want to know what they bring to the table, and that includes their understanding of their faith very much in that whole process. But it also is their understanding of tribal customs that are particular to their own people. And so I basically would say that I'm in a learning mode with regard to that, and I'm sure that you're in a far better position than I am to be able to speak to what your spiritual tradition has to bring. I was in the last session that I held for Iraqis, which was in March of this year. It happened on the, and during that session was a commemoration of the death of the Prophet Muhammad. And what I found very interesting was that there were three of the Iraqis who spoke during this commemoration, all of them Muslim and Shiite. And they were very much presenting Islam as a peace-oriented faith tradition, and say, very much wanting, I think, to speak to us Westerners who were present about changing, as they perceived it at least, our impressions of Islam as being a violent, prone faith. And I've heard this before as well, and I think that it's very important for us as Westerners to hear that. I think still that they're speaking as a Christian theologian too, there are certain elements certainly within my faith tradition that can easily be turned to espouse violence as well as peace and reconciliation. I think that's true for most any religious tradition. You can find different elements present within it. And I would hope that there would be a focus on where we can build this commonality, actually, between different faith traditions. But rather than spell out specifics that I don't know a whole lot about, I'd probably prefer to let people like you do that and learn from you. You also talked about, my brief notes here were the psychological impact of violence, and you talked about it particularly in relation to jihad. I don't know if I can comment in relation to jihad. What I would say myself is that I think that the psychological effects of violence certainly affect all of us, whoever may experience that, and that faith traditions, as I have seen them, have a tremendous amount of resources to bring to people who experience that psychological, traumatic kind of experience. I see an awful lot of what I do as dealing primarily with trauma and trauma recovery. One of the things that I'm not speaking to an Islamic perspective in particular, but referring to Bosnia, where I did a lot of training even during the war as well as after the war. And one of the things that I remember asking in a mixed religious grouping was, what do your religious leaders do with your time? This was during the war. The answer I got from all of them was the thing that took up most of their time was conducting funerals. And what I began doing then was challenging different groups, whether they're Christian or Jewish, which there is in Sarajevo, or Muslim, how can you, in fact, through your faith tradition, help your people to face grief? And probably that becomes the very first step toward any reconciliation process, because if people cannot, in a healthy way, face grief, then they're probably going to be continuing to function out of a victimhood mentality that, in fact, engenders aggressiveness as perceived by others. And so I'd be interested in learning more. I remember hearing some about what all those traditions have done with that in Bosnia, including Islamic, but I have a lot to learn about that whole process. The last series of questions, I would say, not just one question. Just war. I didn't hear an exact question there. I just heard more of a statement, I guess, about just war and the difficulty of using just war theory to justify current war. No, it was the man next to you. And
basically,
I would...
What I was trying to do was draw attention to the fact that maybe Kosovo is based on a different set of premises, and Iraq a different set of premises. When you start the way you started in Iraq, it's very difficult to justify an awful lot of things, including trust and friendship. And if you are going to begin with that, which is a very sound way of beginning, it's what we did in the ecumenical movement that we were all involved in Europe in the 60s and 70s, then it's going to be very difficult to start on that basis in a situation like Iraq if you come in the way you came in.
That was interesting.
It was a little different.
Well, actually, I personally wrote an article that questioned whether or not Kosovo war can be justified on the basis of just war. And it was based on my own experience, actually, at attempting to... I mentioned in Bosnia that I was involved in trying to initiate back-channel communication. I was actually involved in that, the war in Kosovo, when I was at CSIS here, dealing with both the Milosevic regime and the State Department, and got to the Milosevic regime, actually, through a deputy to the Kosovo Serbian Orthodox bishop. Long story how that happened, but this man who was an advisor, actually a political advisor to the Bishop of Kosovo, was intimately involved in these sessions to attempt to find a negotiated settlement before the war happened. And we basically got into proposing a whole lot of things, including what kind of NATO troops might enter Kosovo without a war. And so I personally think that all of that could have been followed up on in official negotiation channels, and you might have had a very different result to the war in Kosovo had it been. But for various reasons was not. But what I would, I guess, question at this point, one of the main things that I question that on a number of grounds, one of the main things that I question about probably most any war that I know of is whether or not it really fulfills the criteria of being a last resort. And that was my main criticism of the war in Kosovo, that I don't think it was a last resort. Many people depicted it that way, but I think without considering possibilities that could be considered. I'll leave just war at that for a moment.
from a theological point of view, it's absolutely crucial. Mm-hmm. And it depends where you come from theologically.
Well, personally, I'm not a pacifist. I would basically use just war theory to determine my response to the possibility of war. So although I don't deny theoretically the possibility, I cannot say that I know of a war that I have seen I think would be justifiable on those grounds. I'm going to skip a few things here because I want to get to some other questions too. But in particular, I was interested in the very last thing you said about the whole focus on development. I've just barely finished, as of June 1st, working for Mercy Corps, which is a humanitarian aid and development agency. I've worked for them for the last 18 months. In fact, it was under their auspices that I did the work that I've been doing in Iraq. And it's interesting you're talking about emphasis of the practical versus talking about religion. It's one of the reasons that I'm not working for Mercy Corps anymore, is that I was basically informed that I could not do anything with religion in conflict if I continue to work for Mercy Corps, which has been a mainstay of what I've been doing. And I don't mean to be developing just a negative portrayal of Mercy Corps, but some of the issues I think are significant because I think they branch out to some extent broader within the development world and not just Mercy Corps, although the different agencies would be different on this. If you talk with World Vision, that has a very church-related origin, then you have a different kind of perspective on it. But essentially the fear was that if I was dealing too much with radical religious groups, that it could, in fact, have detrimental effects on their development programming. And that the important thing was that they develop effective economic, particularly economic development programming, although they're also very much involved in civil society development, and that this nothing should threaten that kind of program. And I agree that there are tensions that could threaten it, therefore raise very interesting questions. I'm leaving, actually, Washington on Wednesday to go to Boston. I'm asked specifically to address this topic in Boston, so I've been thinking about it a good deal. I won't go into all of what I'm going to say there, but essentially I think there is a tension between development organizations that tend to want conflict management added onto their development programming so that they can deal more effectively with the situations that they face, helping different communities to be able to work together so that in community mobilization you can enhance, in fact, the cooperative effort and, in fact, the what is produced in the long term. And what they also want is what literally the country director for Mercy Corps in Sri Lanka said to me when I went there a year ago was, help us to see the minefields so we don't step on them. That's what they wanted in terms of my conflict assessment of Sri Lanka. And when I began indicating what I saw the minefields to be, what I thought might be done about that by Mercy Corps, they rejected all the ideas that I had because they were afraid. And it said right up front, they're afraid that if they really implemented any of these things, that it would, they could get thrown out of the country. I think that's a bit of an exaggeration, that they would get thrown out of the country. But that's their fear. And so I think there is a tension, obviously, there between conflict management and development programming that is actually very central to me at the moment because of my recent experience. And it has also, at least to some degree, a relationship with how you deal with religious conflict. So with that, I think I'll...
Yeah, thank you. Okay, Rick, please.
Thanks, David. Rick Barton here at CSIS. It's welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
I have two sets of questions. You've, in a way, mentioned a number of obstacles for policymakers. I mean, you haven't really presented them as obstacles, but if I go back through some of them, some of your key principles, build relationships, which takes time, boom, an obstacle to a policymaker. Recognizing groups, just even getting the data, the most basic analysis of who's out there, that we've missed entire groups because the ground analysis doesn't exist. The pluralism within groups may not be convenient for us as well. The policy problem of dealing with religion, that it doesn't really fit in a box. The policy problem of being PNG'd from a country, if you're a diplomat or the last thing you want to do is be kicked out of a place, or next to last thing. It should be quite a bit. I think we should be more willing to do it, but these are not. I think we have ways around it. But anyway, you presented a number of policy obstacles, so I'd like to get your sense of which sort of two or three obstacles you think are at the top of the list of our, let's call it, mediocre practice around this field. And then maybe a more introspective one for you would be, okay, you really had two big experiences, Kosovo and Iraq, let's say. Those have been your dominant experiences in terms of really seeing places up close. What mistakes did you make taking your experience from Kosovo to Iraq? What surprise that you might cite?
Ideas on alternative solutions. It seems like an idea with a lot of potential, but also potentially risky, especially if you're coming out from outside of the religious tradition. It requires some level of credibility, some level of knowledge, but especially credibility seems like a big issue if this were a recommendation we were going to make to policymakers. Have you seen that be a big issue? How can or is this a place where government officials, where officials just don't fit in, where this isn't a good place for them to play a role? Should they just be working with advisors who can go in as theologians, the way you described sort of the advantage that you have there?
Jennifer Brinkerhoff, George Washington University. And I'm just wondering, I understand that you've primarily worked with existing groups and religious faiths and everything, but my question is more about how would one begin to think about preventing people from becoming increasingly fundamentalist in their beliefs and practice, increasingly exclusionary, and what is driving that kind of movement?
To follow up on that, because I think for some of us who come from, the liberal Protestant tradition, there's a huge emphasis on sort of walking humbly before your God, or the concept of humility is really reinforced on a consistent basis. And I just wonder if that, is that a dividing line as well that you find?
You're all right there, David. No food, and he's done so well for the last hour and a half.
And all of this in, what, 5 minutes? Okay. Okay, let's see here. Building relationships. I'm trying to reconstruct what you said here, Rick. My notes. Yeah, okay, right, okay. Two or three basic obstacles. I mean, I think that despite your talking about humility as being, you know, typical of liberal Protestantism, may or may not be. I think that humility is one of the basic things that I would say, but I would also say that I think many times those traditions that espouse it don't practice it. And that even the, quote, breadth of perspective that I see is not stated with a sense of humility.
Are there some that do not state it, though? Are there some that reject the humility concept? I understand the ideal, but I just wonder if that's not even an ideal in some cases.
Well, I think the real question in my perspective is not who states it, but who practices it. And I mean, I refer, for example, to the statement of Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president, who I think most people would not view as somebody with a terribly open mind or someone coming from a perspective of humility. And he might not use that language himself, I don't know. And yet, he's willing to step back and say, where, Mr. President, can I connect with you? And from my perspective, that's a significant step to take. And I think that I find myself wondering, I don't know if there's been any response. I've not heard a response from President Bush to that. I'd be interested to know what it was, if there ever has been one. I suppose there could be one that's not been made public, but I haven't seen it. I find that very often sometimes the people that we label as terribly intolerant, in fact, when approached in a different way, can in fact, or maybe not even just when approached, they can operate in ways that surprise us. To take a very different example, I ended up during the back channel communication I was doing with the Milosevic government dealing extensively with one of Milosevic's primary consultants and advisors. He was one of a troika that was one of the top three people that were at Milosevic's right hand throughout the crisis. And I got to know this person before the war and began establishing a relationship with him. And on the one hand, he would be terribly nationalistic in terms of things he would say. And yet it became increasingly clear, he was a Serb from Kosovo, increasingly clear that he was terribly afraid of what was going to happen in Kosovo. And he was actually desperately trying to find a way to convince Milosevic not to fight in Kosovo. That's one of Milosevic's closest right-hand people. And he ended up brainstorming with us ideas of what might make sense to Milosevic in order to get Milosevic to say no. And I'd say to him, well, so what's the possibility of convincing Milosevic of anything here? And he said, well, it really depends. He says, if you come in with a creative idea that Milosevic is open at that moment, he may be only open for a half hour to some suggestion. If you happen to hit it right, then you get a possibility. If you get it wrong, you can get absolutely thrown out of his office. no matter who you are. I could get thrown out of his office. And so what he's saying, though, is that despite all of this, what would be perceived, rightly so, as a completely intolerant kind of perspective, there are holes somehow there. And I think we need to find those kinds of holes. Maybe don't call them holes. I'm calling them that at the moment. I can't think of a better word. But those ways in which you can make that connection. I think that's what we need to do. We need to do it whether we're policymakers or whether we're outside of government. I think that's... I'm going to actually leave that as my primary statement and then move on to something else. That we need to somehow find that. And... at the very end of my talk, I'll say a little more. At the very end of my talk, talked about different things that, in fact, will suggest a second thing that's important. So I'll make that one other point. And that is that I think we need to, at the same time, open ourselves with humility to the other person and find out where they are open. We need to have some kind of self-examination process. And I referred to the fact that I think that at the beginning of the Cold War, I think the U.S. foreign policy demonstrated that. And I don't see that demonstrated now in U.S. foreign policy, that I think there's a sense that we had back then of the need to bind ourselves to international agreements, to be able to say our action has to be legitimized by the agreement of other parties. I mean, we can't just go in and do what we want because we think it's right. So I think that there's that need to be self-reflective. That's also another aspect of humility, perhaps. We need to be listening to the other, and we need to be self-examining of ourselves. Well, those are very broad attitudinal perspectives as opposed to concrete policy decisions. But I think those attitudes frame an awful lot of policy that, from my perspective, we need to re-examine. So now I am going to move on. The next question I saw is primarily asking about whether government officials can play a role. But I think that was only the last part of what you said.
When we're working with religious fundamentalists, and whether they can play a role in working with theology, this idea of using, working within theological ideas.
Okay, I remember now.
To raise questions.
Right. How can we use their theology? And will it be seen as maybe patronizing?
Right.
If we attempt to do that, I would say yes, it certainly can be, and one has to be very careful. And it's part of why I attempt then to get them to articulate it rather than me articulating it, so that then it's theirs. And I could know certain things about a particular theological perspective, but not know the uniqueness of this particular group's orientation toward it, which could be very important, in fact. And so my approach is normally to ask them to articulate how they perceive these. To give you an example from Iraq, this is one of the places where I'd say if their culture, their tribal custom, probably as much as their religious orientation, that produce a very different dynamic than I would experience in the West. What I often do in terms of dealing with Western audiences, and did this a lot in the Balkans, was talking about how we deal with blame. How we deal with our own sense of responsibility for whatever kind of negative conflict situation we're involved in. Where do we reflect on ourselves? Some of what I've just been saying about U.S. foreign policy, the need to reflect on oneself. As we began dealing with that with Iraqis, what we became aware of was that there was a tremendous reluctance to even consider doing that, which for me is very fundamental to how I view the world and my need to be self-reflective. And what came out of that discussion was the sense that for them, they had to be extremely careful that blame was not attributed then to their group, to their family, to their tribe, to their clan, that they had to protect their group from ever being tagged with that sense of blame. And so for me, coming as a Westerner, where there's a lot of individualized concept of that, where, yeah, you take responsibility. I said this that hurt your feelings. I'm sorry that I did that. Now let's get on with talking about other issues. I apologize. There was a sense that people were less ready to do that, at least as we were interacting with the particular issues that we were dealing with. And so really had to ask them kind of how they would deal with it. Like, you were raising your hand a moment ago. Maybe you have...
Wait, sorry, just one more question.
Yeah, I just thought that maybe this was a comment on what I was saying right now. No?
Well, it is.
I mean, are you okay with her coming with a comment? Okay.
Successful, what I've seen happen is that the Western counterpart, not so much the religion, but the secularist, becomes competitive and wants the stage. I mean, it becomes a competitive struggle. And here, it has become a struggle of funding. You know what I mean? So it, I mean, there's the politics of funding here, and I think that these are very relevant in terms of the potential for success, you know, wherever else. And your comments about Mercy Corps, in part, to me, reflect some of these kinds of, you know, issues that relate to funding and, you know, the forecast of activities and so forth. And I think that unless they're dealt with, you know, I mean, it's just like a status quo keeps going on. I mean, this is not, these issues are not new. I mean, they were happening in the 70s and 60s. So I was wondering what you thought about that. And what's your sense? I mean, do you feel that those, don't they play a large part in why we continue to, you know, sort of never, not to get through past a certain point, you know, that we're not, we don't get past
I have to ask you a follow-up there. What exactly are the things that keep us from getting past?
Turf. And,
mm-hmm.
And this, I don't know how to fucking, you know, capture the right word. Turf, the people that I see who say authentic voices should be, you know, included, then include the ones that may not necessarily be the most, you know, the most, you know, most helpful. I mean, you know, their message over the last like 30 years, making a comparison, they say the same things they were saying 30 years ago, that sort of thing. I mean, how to get past those things.
Let me quickly respond to that and also to your question, and then I think we're probably out of time at that point. Yeah, I think the issues of turf all over the place, that's one of the fundamental realities, as I see it, of the human condition, that often even when we don't think we are, we're still struggling over turf issues, which is really control. And I think that's true not only of U.S. and Westerners, it's true of virtually everybody around the world, just we happen to be citizens of the one remaining superpower, the turf that we represent is with a certain amount of clout that often I think we're even unaware of how much of that clout we bring with us, even as non-governmental representatives. And as I heard your concern, it was, what do we do then with the voices that we deem to be problematic?
Yes.
And
why they're being problematic.
And I guess what, I mean, I've said a lot about that already. What I'll simply say at this point is that I think what we need to look for in that problematic voice is what can we connect with that is, in fact, legitimate aspiration? And how can we affirm that and then work with whatever party that is in order to help them to achieve legitimate aspirations that also don't delegitimize anyone else? It's a difficult process, but I think that's the question. And then your concerns to come to the end here. I heard the basic question that you were asking was how to prevent people from becoming fundamentalist or exclusionary. Is that correct? I guess, first of all, I don't think that you prevent anybody from doing anything. And so I'm not sure that I would frame it exactly in that way. However, having said that, I think that I think there are ways one can relate to people either who are already in that perspective or who may, in fact, move in that direction. I mean, many people will, in fact, link the economic deprivation of many parts of the world with the rise of religious fundamentalism. I think there's some connection there. I don't think it's the only connection that there is. I think that dealing with economic disparity, dealing with poverty, for example, can in fact be one way of attempting to meet the needs of people who then won't see perhaps the need to turn to extremism. And yet at the same time, we have to recognize that some of the leadership of some of the more extremist fundamentalist groups have not come from the poorest classes. And they respond to the poverty of their group as a whole often, but they themselves often don't come from that. And so I think that what we're looking at is something greater than just how you respond to economic factors. In fact, it's very much caught up with a sense of the thing that I said at the beginning is at the heart of the whole fundamentalist ethos, and that is the sense that our values are being threatened. I've just barely begun reading a book with my wife. We like reading to each other out loud, and I can't remember the title of this book. It's a series of vignettes written by a Western woman about her encounters with Islamic societies. And she's describing this one encounter that she has with a young Arab woman, 25 years old, who has recently become an Islamic fundamentalist. And she said this woman's mother had been among the leading people within her society of the feminist movement in her country a generation ago. And now the daughter is veiling herself, covering herself, and espousing a very, very radical conservative perspective that seems totally antithetical to what her mother stood for. And so she's beginning to reflect on she knew this woman during this transition. So she knew her before, and she knows her afterward. And she said she was at first tremendously distressed by what she was observing. And then she said she began to actually interact with the person and begin to have a sense for why this woman was making the choices that she was making. And it's a whole series of things that she recounts as to why that was. But just to give you one example, what she said was that one thing this woman said to her was, "I find that when I dress this way, that men respond more to my mind than to my body." And now that may not be true of all men, but at the same time, it's her experience. And, you know, from her perspective, she appreciates that. One of the things that I found in relating to these Iraqi women, two of whom ran for parliament during the time that I've been working for them. They didn't win, but they ran for parliament. They could not travel anywhere without a male escort, including to the workshop that I was leading. So their male escorts were present. Yet they, can you imagine someone running for the U.S. Congress having to have an escort everywhere you went? These women were veiled. They were completely covered. You'd think that they had tremendously conservative orientations toward everything, and yet one of them was actually the head of a local NGO who was basically the whole focus of what she was doing was training in democracy. Extremely intelligent woman, who I have to say I was surprised. I expected something much more conservative in terms of her whole orientation, but it wasn't true. And so, you know, I look at someone like that and I say, "What is it my place to prevent her from anything?" I don't think it is. On certain things, she had, you know, very, very conservative religious perspectives that I might find very difficult to embrace myself. But on the other hand, she was coupling it with things that were, I'm sure, from her society's perspective, even radical. And yet she was able to do that, hold all this together in some way, and with a tremendous sense of humility. She said, I've come here to learn. And she wants to learn in ways that will help her to function in her society. At the very end, we were having them choose things that they would work on together, and we were dividing into particular local groups so that they were from the same city and they could work together. And after putting them through this exercise at the very closing meal that we had, I talked a great deal with one of the men in the meal at the table or over supper about what he was going to do to enable this particular project that they were talking about implementing. Well, the same woman I'm talking about came up with another woman to talk with me afterwards, and they said, you know, we can't work on that project. I said, we don't think it's really workable. I said, why don't you think it's workable? I've just had this long conversation with this man from your group, from the same municipality, about all the possibilities of things that he could do. And they said, he's a man, we're women. And we know that we can't do that. We said, we can do some other things, but we cannot do that. It's going to take him doing that, and that's fine. I said, okay, great. You know, tell me what you can do. And they've actually been working on issues within a women's local NGO in terms of what that local NGO might do within society. And so they know their own limits and boundaries within their society. They're tremendously creative in terms of how they're going about approaching that, but they're not willing to take a Western critique that it should be somehow a woman's role to engage in this over here. It's okay for them if they're not. So I guess it's a long way of saying that I don't primarily try to prevent people from becoming something, but try to encourage them toward becoming something.
Good, thank you. And thank you for a really fascinating discussion today. Thank you also to our PCR team, Leora and Shannon, and everyone else for helping to organize this, and for all of you people for coming. It's nice to see new faces at an event. If anybody wants to sign up for the brief, if you aren't already receiving the PCR brief, please let us know, and we'll tell you about more events in the future. So thanks again, everyone. Thank you.